Welcome to the Running in the Center of the Universe podcast. I'm Ashland Dave, and I'm recording live from my podcast studio in Ashland, Virginia. Thanks for coming along. And this is Ashland Dave, and this is the Running in the Center of the Universe podcast, episode 151. This will be the Graveyard 100 report, 100K report. It is the week, today's March 14th, so it's the week of March 14th, 2012. And, I got a lot of information. I ran the Graveyard 100K this past March 10th. I'm still recovering from that. I did finish the race. I'll talk about my finishing time as we kind of dissect the event. It was a pretty good event. I had a lot of fun, had a lot of support, and I just can't say enough about the race director, Brandon Wilson, who did his best to get everybody accommodated, and especially to direct an event that stretched out, 100 miles. The Graveyard 100 was actually two events, utilizing basically the same course. It was a 100-miler and then a 100-kilometer event. I did the 100-kilometer event. Had a lot of support from folks that lent me a lot of well wishes before I went down there. I just want to touch on some of that because it was really nice. First and foremost would be Sandy, who sponsored me for this race, and I really do appreciate that a lot, Sandy, and I was glad I was able to bring home a finisher's medal on behalf of your very your sponsorship. For the rest of the listeners out there, Sandy paid for a good portion of my race fee, so I didn't want to let her down. So, Sandy, I really do appreciate that very much. And I think she said she's going to be sending me a 100K sticker, so I'll be looking for that. Also, wanted to thank Chris from the runningafterdaylight.blogspot.com. I interviewed Chris in episode 150, which was when I interviewed him about his 100K, which was down in Florida just in February. And he gave me lots of advice, and Sandy gave me lots of advice too. So I wanted to thank you guys for that. Also, several other people checked in, Tim, Tom, Ashland, Bob, Christina, Adam, and Meriwether, and in one of Adam's emails, he says he liked the old podcast intro music, so maybe I'll bring that back one of these days. He said it's kind of like an old sofa, you don't ever really want to get rid of it. Also heard from Neil. Neil's going to be sweeping the Oak Mountain 50K on March 31st. That's down near Birmingham, Alabama. The race was full. He wasn't able to get in, but the race director asked him if he'd be willing to sweep the course. So I'll be very interested to hear how that goes. Neil, he and I have exchanged some emails. I've never talked to anybody that swept a course before, so I'm just kind of curious, what all it entails. I guess, picking up markers and making sure that people aren't left out there. Of course, Dirt Dog, appreciate all the advice I got from him and the support. And Tom, reference to Tom and I had been exchanging a lot of emails. This is Tom from North Carolina, in reference to how ultramarathoning is really a solo sport. It's a selfish sport, and you have to kind of be careful what you ask other people to do. And I had a crew for my race down in the Outer Banks, so I will talk about how that helped me in this particular case as I kind of go through the race here. Like I said in the last email, I wanted to talk a little bit about Dr. Smitty's email that he sent about the length of suffering and doing these long races and what's the point of all that. So we got a lot to get to. This may be a part one and two. Not sure. I don't usually like to have the podcast go past an hour, but it's probably going to take me a while to get through this race report. So hopefully you'll be interested and we'll stick around for that and listen to the race report. Let's see. Okay, the Graveyard 100, which was started on March 10th for me, ended the following morning on March 11th, and that was in the Outer Banks, North Carolina. It was two separate events, like I had mentioned. It was the 100-miler. And it was a 100K, and the 100-miler started at 5 a.m. on Saturday, March 10th, up in Corolla, North Carolina, which is, I guess, it's the most northern part you can get in a vehicle on asphalt up on the Outer Banks. After that, I think you can take four-wheel drive vehicles in the sand. But from what I understand, that race started right there on the where the road starts. The 100K started later in the day at 3 p.m. in South Nag's Head at one of the public beach access points. And there was only 18 people had registered for the 100K. And if I'm not mistaken, I think, let me see how many finishers there were. I've got the results right here. There's only 14 people finished. So there were a couple no-shows. Me not being one of those, but anyway, the 100 miler had 82 runners, and there was a lot of drops on that. Let's see, it was 44 finishers on that, with the person who came in last place at 29 hours. So there's a lot of people dropped from that. Lots of DNFs. I'm just looking at the results here. I can't tell. Probably, you know, well, whatever 82 minus 44 is. I can't do the public math. So you can figure that one out. But anyway, I was one of the 100K runners, and if you're familiar with the Outer Banks at all, if you're not, I'll talk about this anyway. The whole island is measured by a milepost system, and when you come on the island, it starts at milepost one. Now, the northern part of the island is not measured by milepost. If I'm not mistaken, it's pretty much the southern part. So I guess it's not the whole thing. But anyway, where I started was around milepost 17.5, and I remember when I came in at the end of the race, it was like milepost 60 something. I mean, it was just crazy. The whole event was just insane. I still can't believe that I actually finished. But anyway, what initially started with just me and my crew traveling down the Outer Banks to do the event, it kind of blossomed into a multi-family weekend trip. When I had first registered for the race, once I found it, and then when I found out that there was going to be a 100K event added to it, which is what I was interested in, you know, I registered right away and started getting my crew together. And since the race started at 3 p.m. on a Saturday, and it was going to be an overnight race, my initial plan was just to drive down Saturday morning, do the race, and have somebody, my crew, drive me back home when I was done, who, you know, somebody could have a nap. Well, you know, as people's family members, as my crew's spouses and family members kind of learned more about what was going on, you know, more people wanted to go, and then it was Bob's wife's birthday, and they have access to a house down there in the Avon area. So we kind of had to alter the plans a little bit to accommodate, you know, the needs and interests of other people. So what kind of started as just a simple idea blossomed into actually one hell of a weekend. It turned out to be really work out really good. But what I did was the people I assembled for my crew, each one was marathoners. It was Ash and Bob, Tom, and Rodney. And I've talked about Tom and Rodney numerous times in the podcast. Each of these guys has a different perspective on distance running, and so I think I'd really assembled a really good crew. Ash and Bob had helped me through my first marathon in 2006, which was the Richmond Marathon. He ran the last couple miles with me, and then I've done marathons and ultra marathons with Tom and Roddy. So overall, I had a great group. I knew they wouldn't let me down. It was going to be difficult. You know, you're asking people to stay up all night and take care of you, and I've met many times I made sure they knew it was an overnight thing, and you know, there's no hard feelings if they don't want to do it. I just need somebody who's interested in doing it. So I had actually almost too much, you know. It was great. I saw other crews down there with just one person. I don't know how they do it. Of course, there was also uncrewed people, which is a whole different, you know, it's a whole different beast. And you know, I could probably do a whole podcast, you know, comparing and contrasting crewed and uncrewed. But the race allowed for a crew in a vehicle to access the runner generally every 6 to 8 miles. So I took advantage of that. There's nothing wrong with that. If the race allows it, the distance is hard enough for me. So I definitely had a crew. Now, we all went down to the Outer Banks at different times on Friday, March 9th because of family obligations. For example, my daughter had to go to school. There was a pre-race meeting at 5 o'clock that was mandatory. That turned out to be more of a question and answer thing, but I was glad we went. Plus, you get to kind of see who else is doing the event, because you know I was only going to be with a small group of people for the 100K. So we got down there, plenty of time to I had reserved a hotel room for Friday night because I did not want to make the trip from Nagshead down to Bob's house in Avon, which was about 40 to 45 minutes. I just decided I was going to stay right there, hit the grocery store, and do everything all in one little area. We went to the pre-race meeting. And now the pre-race meeting, you know, gave us a chance to, well, we picked up our race number and a T-shirt. It was a pretty cool shirt. You know, they had some other stuff in there in the bag from some of the sponsors. The Brandon came in and told us a little bit about the race. Now it was really interesting to do some people watching in there because, you know, all these people are down there to do 100 miles or 100 kilometers. So they're all nuts. You know, I mean, they're all crazy people like me. And so it was interesting to kind of look around the room to see who was super crazy. And of course we eavesdropped. So we heard one lady talking about bad water, and it turns out that her name is Brenda Carawan, and she wrote an excellent race report about her experience. She won the 100-mile event. And if you go to brendacarawan.com, you'll see a pretty cool website about her race experience. She's going to do another 100-miler later this month, and she actually got a picture of her feet on there after the 100-miler. And, you know, you should put my feet next to her feet, and you'll see – you see who's got the ugly feet, that's for sure. But she didn't seem to have any feet problems. But anyway, we did some people watching, and then some of the dumb questions started coming out, stuff that was all in the participants' race packet that had been emailed out. So at that point in time, I thought that it would be okay to leave the meeting. I wouldn't call the meeting a waste of time because it is good to have those meetings. It's just that it kind of got into a point where people were asking questions on stuff that was all emailed out in the race packet. And I know those people who asked those questions had email because that's how they found out about the pre-race meeting. That was an email. So we left and went to go get something to eat. And we went to my favorite restaurant of all in the Outer Banks, which is called Daredevil Pizza. It's on the Beach Road at Milepost 9. Absolutely love that place, and that is where I go every time I'm down there. I just make a point to go down there. It's open year-round. Now, the we consisted of me, Tom, and Rodney. Everybody else in my family was still on their way down. Bob's family was on the way down. Matter of fact, the place where Bob and his family were going to go to eat was too full, so they ended up coming down to Daredevil Pizza, and they were kind of coming in as we were leaving. And they were all continuing on down another hour down the road. So the big group meetup was planned for the next day at the race start, which was at 3 p.m. So we had so much time on Saturday. So we, you know, had a pitcher of beer at the pizza place. We had picked up some beers at the grocery store as well as some other supplies. So we went back to the room, and I think we watched Austin Powers or something on TV. But then I kind of started milling around, and since Tom was my crew captain, I started explaining to him all the different plastic containers I had. Now, I brought a lot of stuff. Weather forecast kind of changed, was changing each day with wind. Didn't look like it was going to rain at all, so I didn't really know. You know, I haven't run all throughout the night before, so I don't know what it's like. Is it cold at night? I know I'd be stopping to get refreshed at the crew access points, so I would want to put a jacket on. I just brought a lot of different stuff, and with some of the foot problems I've had in the other ultras I've done, I had a separate foot care kit to address the problems I was going to have with my feet. Then I had an electronics bag, which had iPods, Garmins, cameras. I had separate containers for my night gear, fuel, clothing. I didn't want anything to get lost. The race was, since it was an overnight race, everybody in my crew was going to be sleep deprived, and I didn't want anybody to get confused about where anything was when I needed it. And as it turns out, the container idea actually worked out pretty good. But what I think I would do the next time was I would actually probably break down break down the containers a little bit smaller. When I'm talking about plastic containers, I'm talking about the ones you get at the, you know, the dime store. These, you know, like shoebox size, maybe a little bit bigger, with the lids that kind of clip on the top. I've found that those work a lot better than duffel bags or gear bags. So fueling, obviously I finished the race, so my fueling was pretty important. My main thing was the Boost energy drinks. These things are just magic to me. They're liquid calories. They get absorbed quick, I think. I didn't vomit at all during this race, so I know these things worked real well for me, and I think I drank all six of them throughout the time out on the road. And it took me just over 15 hours to cover the distance, so that's how much time I'm talking about here, and I'll get to that finishing time here in a little. Well, it's actually almost 15 and a half hours. I also used S-Caps every half hour. I drank Succeed Amino Powder, which I mixed with water, and I had pretty much a 16-ounce bottle of that every hour, if not more than that. The Amino is designed to go for endurance events 9 hours or longer, and again, it worked out good for me. It kept me going. I had some peanut granola bars, hard-boiled eggs, PBJ sandwiches, and goo, and I don't know how many goos I took. I probably took maybe, you know, four or half dozen, but the hard-boiled eggs really worked well for me. And so, hey, Mike, up in the Dirt Dog podcast, he and I had discussed that, and I told him it was something I was going to try in training. Well, it worked in training, and Mike, it worked, you know, got me to the finish line. Of course, it didn't help my feet. That was the main thing, and I'll get to that later in the report. But I liked having the eggs. I would take them with me, eat them kind of slowly, and I just liked kind of having some solid food. It just made me feel a little bit better. You know, it's protein. I don't think the protein is going to be absorbed, but so fast into the body, and I don't really know what protein will do for you during an ultra. But I liked having that density of the food in my stomach, and that's what really helped. So that did. It turns out it worked okay, and I know you and I've had some discussions about that. And then Pringles, which I never had any. I brought Pringles down there because I really like those and they're easy to eat out of a tube. But turns out I didn't have those. Now the race had race provided aid station food, and that was they were about every 20 miles apart. And because of the way that of where the 100K was starting, which was around the 38 mile mark of the race, you know, it didn't start at the beginning. It started pretty much at the 38-mile mark for the 100-miler. The aid stations weren't – I didn't really look into those that much. And what I mean by that is I pretty much brought all my own stuff just in case the aid stations had some problems or I didn't care for the stuff. And I did go through three aid stations. First one was only at the 6 mile mark, so I didn't really pay much attention to that. And then the next one, which was right before the marathon mark, had lots of stuff in there. But I had my own stuff that I'd been using in training, and I guess I just stuck with that because that's what I knew. So let me talk a little bit about foot care a little bit. Taped the bottoms of my feet and my heels with duct tape. I'd read the book Fixing Your Feet by John Vonhoff and had learned taping techniques for prevention. At the Keys Ultra last year, the 50-miler I did down in the Florida Keys, I had significant blistering around my heels, which was really hard to cope with towards the end of the race because, you know, every time you take a step, it's that sensitivity on the heels. And post-race recovery, having blisters on your heels was brutal. So I wanted to do something to prevent that, so that's why I taped my heels. I had no blisters on my heels whatsoever from this race. Not at all. Heels were totally intact. Matter of fact, I think halfway through the race, I actually took the tape off my heels because I think at that point I was going to be okay. No friction was happening, so I took the tape off. Now, all the problems actually went to the front of my feet. And boy, did I have some problems. If you've listened to the podcast before, then everybody knows what happened to the pads of my feet at North Face when I was out laid up for 2 weeks. And something kind of similar to that happened to me down in the Outer Banks, but the skin didn't break, and I'll talk about that. So before the race started, I applied Vaseline in between all my toes just to reduce the friction there. And then we got started. Now, the crew access was an interesting situation. Crew access was actually worked out pretty good. We used Tom's pickup truck, which is a four-door pickup truck. The aid stations, the official race provided aid stations were about every 20 to 24 miles apart. So that meant that I was only going to see three of them for the 100K. But in between the aid stations were water stops. And this meant either water coolers on a rack or gallon jugs of water sitting next to the road. But crew access was allowed at each aid station and each water stop. So I obviously took advantage of that, like I mentioned earlier. So that meant that I was able to get access to my gear, my fuel, some conversation with others about every 6 to 8 miles. And we used the back of Tom's truck to hold everything. For some reason, I thought that everything would be accessible on the tailgate and we'd be hanging out at the tailgate at each stop and fueling there and sitting down. But it got so cold that I ended up sitting in the truck all the time. And there was no rain, thankfully, but we did have a tent in case of the rain. God, I'm so glad it didn't rain. All right, well, the race started at 3 o'clock, and Brandon, the race director, had hoped to start the 100K earlier than that if everybody had checked in, but there was one holdout, apparently, who never showed, and I guess some other people he was not expecting. I thought 17 of the 18 people started, but it turned out I think it was just 14 or... Guys, I keep forgetting how many people did the 100K. 16 started and 14 finished. There are two DNFs on there. Now, anyway, the person didn't show up, so he did start it at 3 o'clock. Now, keep that in mind. 3 o'clock is when the race started, not 3:10, not 3:20, not 2:50. It was right at 3 o'clock, and because that actually will play a role in what my finishing time is the following morning, and I'll get to that when we, because it's either 15 hours 15 minutes or 15 hours and 25 minutes. I'm not really sure. I think it's 15:25, but they have me down as 15:15, which I'll take, but I didn't earn it, so I'm kind of one of these guys that I'm a purist, I guess, in that sense. I don't want a finishing time that I didn't earn. Anyway, you know, we've been waiting around all day. We went and had lunch at a place called Country Deli down there at Milepost 13. It's a place that's also open year-round that I used to go to when my brother used to run a coffee shop down there, and got a turkey club, bought everybody else lunch. And then we went to the race start, I guess, about 1 o'clock and just hung out. And we saw 100 milers going past. We had been spending some time driving the route and seeing some of the 100 milers, which was pretty cool. You know, it was really windy and the sun was out and it looked like people were doing okay. And, you know, as they came through our location, they were at the 38-mile mark, so none of them were really that bad off. I slept pretty good the night before. Woke up about 7 a.m. And it's kind of funny, when I woke up, just the thought of knowing that I was going to be up all night, you know, for at least 24 hours, was a little bit of a daunting feeling, but you know, this is what I came down there for, so you know, I was excited about it. The first 12.2 miles were just simply wonderful. I felt good, so I ran how I felt. I didn't see anything wrong with that. I ran faster than I probably needed to, but I just knew I'd be walking plenty later on. So what's the, you know, why not run, you know, how you feel? And I was running, you know, just over a 10-minute pace. But it was such a gorgeous day, and I knew I had so much time, you know, and I was going to be doing plenty of walking. I didn't see the harm in just running how I felt. So I started off with a run a mile, walk a tenth, which was easily kept up with on my Garmin. That was just to get a run walk regimen started. I did that, I think, right from mile one. I don't think I wavered from that at all. And Right around the beginning, I just kind of fell right in between everybody. Two females darted off right away. One of them ended up coming in last place, but the other one won the 100K. And her name is... No, it wasn't her that won. She came in second place. Tatiana Spencer was the winner at 8 hours, 16 minutes. Just completely incredible. Marie-Ange Smith came in second with 9 hours, 32 minutes. The two females that darted out at the beginning were this Marie-Ange Smith and Sarah Sousa. And the reason I knew it was her because I saw her at the packet pickup when she said her name. She came in at 17 hours, so I don't know what happened to her. I never passed her, so I don't know what happened. But anyway, I'm getting off on a little bit of a tangent there. But okay, we're talking about race start. Okay, first 12 miles. The weather was absolutely perfect for running. I felt good, like I said. I knew I'd be walking plenty later, so I wasn't worried about, spending too much at the beginning. I felt good. You know, I just say, let me just run how I feel. There's plenty of time to walk later and recover. I had access to my crew at mile 6.3, and it had gotten hot enough, and I was wearing three layers, so I took off the outer layer, turned that in, got a new water bottle, and then the next section, which was miles 6.3 to 12.2, included a structure called the Bonner Bridge, which is 2.5 miles long. And this was the bridge that had been mentioned in the pre-race material that was sent out, that the race director thought he was going to have to shuttle the runners across because of safety issues. But then it turned out we were allowed to run across the bridge, but you still had the option of being shuttled if that's what you wanted. You just had to let them know it at the packet pickup. I decided to run the bridge because, you don't have access to that bridge as a pedestrian normally. There's no reason to. And I stopped several times and took pictures on the bridge. The views were just stunning. It was you could see the ocean from the bridge, the sound, the inlets. It was a pretty high bridge. It was just gorgeous, but it was freezing. Freezing cold at the bridge. I'd already gotten rid of that outer shirt, and even though we had a tailwind all day and most of the night, the wind up on the bridge was just swirling around, and it was freezing. My hands actually had gotten numb from being up there for I guess about a half hour. Well, maybe not a half hour. Of course, I did keep stopping and taking pictures because I like taking pictures, and I probably took too many. I was literally stopping right there on the bridge with cars coming. And the sun was not quite setting yet, but it was low enough in the sky to make some spectacular scenery. And then at the end of the bridge, which was the 12.2 mark, I again had access to my crew. And this is where we were allowed to have pacers for the remainder of the race if we wanted to. That was the first access point. And since I had three people that came down there, I didn't object to having people run with me, and that's where Bob jumped in. Now, Bob had told me that he wanted to try to do at least a half marathon distance while we were down there. Now, while that was really of no consequence to me, because I was, in it for the long haul, I didn't object. So he ran with me for the next 12.4, and then I think he added a little bit of mileage in a parking lot to get up to whatever distance he wanted. But we saw a gorgeous sunset over the Sound. Now, just to kind of give you an idea, if you're not familiar with the Outer Banks, the Outer Banks is a barrier island that is north-south on the east coast of North Carolina. And so there's the ocean to the east, and then in between the barrier island and the mainland is a sound. And the sunset set over the Sound, and it was gorgeous. And I was hoping to see the moon shortly thereafter, just for something to look at, because it had been a full moon the night before. I was told I did not go out and see it, but we couldn't find the moon anywhere. So, I'll mention that here in a few minutes. But this section of the course took us through a very narrow section of the Outer Banks where I think sand is actually brought in to block the ocean from washing over the road. And so as a result, the ocean side of the road was essentially a wall of sand, or a big, huge embankment of sand. And it was weird to think that the ocean's right on the other side, and there were a couple areas where the sand had washed over the road. And of course, you could see the wind you could see the sand blowing across the road, the way the wind was blowing across the road. And, you know, part of me wonders if I got sand in my shoes, and that's why my feet You know what? I wonder if that's what it was. I had gaiters. I never put them on. I just did not think that sand could work its way down into my shoes like it did, because whenever I changed my shoes and socks, I was not pulling sand out of there. I know, you know, it's small. But anyway, this took me up to the 24.6-mile mark, just shy of the marathon mark. This was one of the race-provided aid stations in a it was a great setup inside a community center in an area called Rodanthe. And I sat down for a little bit and took a break, and there was a hot spot developing between the two small toes on my right foot that ended up not being anything later. But I had blisters develop on the inside of my big toes, which I wasn't really feeling, and they were kind of grotesque looking. So I drained those and taped my large toes. Yeah, I put Vaseline in between there, but that didn't seem to work that well. So I was having some issues come up before the marathon mark, which had never come up in training before. I was wearing same shoes, same socks, same everything. And frankly, at 24.6 miles, I mean, that's nothing compared to, you know, what I needed to do. And so I was getting a little bit worried. But the aid station setup was awesome. It was 7:53 p.m. I'd been running for almost 5 hours. I was getting a little tired. You know, hung around for a little bit, ate some food. I was out. I was there for about 12 minutes. I call that a while. But then Rodney was going to take over. We were going to be running through the night together for a while. The next section was only 4.4 miles, but I took an hour to cover that. And it was just to slow things down. There was no rush at all. I did not have an expected finishing time for myself, other than I was going to be able to finish between 5 a.m. and 7 a.m. And whenever I mention times here, I'm not including the switch over to daylight savings time, because that would just confuse things. So I just used the straight clock time. I just figured that I could probably make it between 14 and 16 hours, and I think that's what 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. would be. So, so I just figured that would be a general targeting time. So I didn't have any qualms with hanging out at the aid stations for a little while. But anyway, Rodney took over. I decided to slow things down, and we went on to a 5 and 5 campaign. And so it took about an hour to get those 4.4 miles. I wasn't even half. I kept thinking I need to get to the halfway point. I need to get to the halfway point, and then I'll be on that downhill slide, because I was kind of starting to feel a little bit of a drag of the distance, not getting bored of the event, but it just seemed like I guess because all of a sudden it was dark, and when it's dark you don't see anything, and there's nothing to really there's nothing to look at except for the road in front of you. And any roadkill that comes into your headlamp that you got to step around or not step on. And there was lots of flat roadkill down there. Some stuff we couldn't even tell what it was. Oh, and by the way, on the bridge, tons of dead birds. Bash and Bob told me that what happens is the birds are hovering over the bridge, and then they get hit by container trucks from behind, and that's what kills them. And there was a lot of roadkill on the I guess you wouldn't call it roadkill. Air kill is what birds would be, because they didn't get killed on the road. Anyway, I was starting to kind of feel the drag of running without some stimulation from scenery, and I think that might have been what that was. And it seemed like it took forever to get to the halfway point. There was just no. I was still mentally good though. I wasn't thinking, oh, I got to get this over with. I was enjoying the moment. That's why I went down and did the ultra marathon. That's why I wanted to do one that was so long, was to, you know, test my patience, I guess. So, you know, we did go through some of these small villages, and when we were in the small villages, there is stuff to look at. Of course, everything was closed. Nothing's open. It was kind of eerie a little bit. I think we heard two barking dogs the whole time. And another thing that was on my mind was something that Bob had told me was, apparently in some of those southern villages, there has been an arsonist that has been setting fires, and so he predicted that we might see some police activity down there. But I do know that I just kind of know for a fact that when you have an arsonist, you're not going to see visible police activity. You're going to have, you know, people who are doing surveillance, and you're not going to see them. So maybe people were watching us, and we just didn't see them, but we didn't see any fires. Okay, so we're still looking for the moon. Like I said, I knew the moon was full the night before, was full moon the night before, so I knew there was going to be something out there. And the sky was so clear. I think we saw Jupiter and Mars to the west, two planets that were very close together. And then there was a gap in the sand wall, the embankment, and I saw some light. And so we kind of stopped for a second. And it was the moon rising over the ocean. And I don't think I've ever actually seen the moon rise before over the ocean. It was just, I just remember it was a real cool scene because the moon was kind of a reddish hue. And I remember running for a while once the embankment got lower, just looking to my left just for something to look at because it was so bright. And then eventually it got higher up in the sky and then turned to its normal color. But I don't think I'd ever seen that before. And that was a really, really cool really cool sight. At the 29-mile mark, I switched Garmins. I think that was at one of the crew access points. I can't really remember. And the reason for that was because I had read that the 305 wouldn't last over 12 hours, and that was initially told to me by Chris when I interviewed him. And then I had read up on some stuff after that interview, and there was literature out there that confirmed that. So I had already had a plan to switch Garmins. I do like having the knowing the distance that I've covered on the Garmin. I don't look at the Garmin for pacing, but I was using it also for time of day. So I switched them out, and all time that kind of lot it caused me to lose track of where I was a little bit because I kind of had to start over. And Tom told me that all I had to do was get up to 33 miles on the new Garmin, so that became my new focus, and we started again at mile one. I performed another sock change. Every time I stopped that I could, I did perform a sock change. Maybe that wasn't a very good thing to do, and I was using Drymax socks at the beginning, but I did not notice that those really helped much because I didn't get the most expensive pair. What I think I might do, and I'll probably discuss my feet later in the show, and it looks like I am going to do a part two because right now I'm about 37 minutes into the show, and I think I am going to do a part two just to break it up. But I'm going to have to buy the expensive Drymax socks and try those, but I'll get to that. So I was surprised to see that these blisters were there were blisters happening on my toes again. It was I don't know what the cause of it was. I drained everything, used alcohol wipes to get everything cleaned up, dried the skin really good, but they weren't hurting. I knew I had to deal with them because if they broke, it was going to be an issue, and eventually it's going to be enough because the blister was blistering out to the point where it was touching the second big toe, and eventually that there was just going to be a major issue if the friction kept. So yes, I drained them and I put duct tape right over top of the skin, if that's what you're wondering. I mean, that's okay to do. So the at the 35.5 mile mark, again had access to my crew. Got in there at 10:40 p.m. and Bob was cooking some noodles on the on a camp stove that he brought on the tailgate of the truck. But it was cold. I mean, the wind was blowing. I sat in the truck for a while eating. The next stretch was a long 8.3 miles without access to anything, and I was getting physically tired at this point in time. You know, I was past the 50K mark. Let's see, so from 3 o'clock to 10:40, that's 7 hours 40 minutes. That's how long it took me to cover 35.5 miles. I was getting sleepy. I think I might have fallen asleep for a few minutes in the truck. I'm not sure. Did sit in there for about 20 minutes with the heater blowing full on me. And for some reason, that's when it dawned on me that I was halfway done. I don't think I noticed it before, and the reason for that was because I had that new Garmin, and I wasn't, I don't know. I just know that, oh, yeah, I'm over halfway done. Okay, I'm over halfway done. This isn't going to be so bad. And it was just it felt like a huge mental accomplishment knowing that I was halfway done. So I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually cut it right here. We're going to do a part two of the podcast with the second half of the race, and hopefully you will come back for that. This is Ashland Dave, and I'm running in the Sun of the Universe, Ashland, Virginia, reminding you to run to the finish and keep on running. And don't forget to hug your kids and come back for part two.
The 2012 Ashland Railroad Run from Race the Rail in Ashland, Virginia. Join us on Saturday, April 21st for the 34th annual running of one of Virginia's oldest road races alongside the Jackson through the historic town of Ashland, Virginia, the center of the universe. The certified 10K race is a favorite spring ritual among runners from around the Commonwealth and beyond. It's great for setting a PR. There's also a 5K fun run and a 1 mile kids race. The kids race has cool prizes. Join hundreds of your friends and come to the center of the universe on April 21st and race the rail. If you're lucky, you might be able to run alongside a huge moving train. For more information, go to hannaforarts.org or email ashlanddave@gmail.com. You can also go to raceit.com and type railroad in the search box. I was a 5K marshal last year, and it was fun. Run Ashland first. See you there.